welcome to the Great American Novel Podcast. I'm Scott Yarbrough.
And I'm Kirk Kernett.
And Kirk, the book we're discussing today is Carson McCullers' 1940 novel, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter.
Probably the most famous literary debut, I would say, in American literary history, maybe even more so than F. Scott Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise, a novel that was published when its author, Carson McCullers, was all of 23 years old and yep. was a bestseller, very much celebrated, was very central to the canon, I think, all the way up until, you know, maybe 20 years ago. I think it slid a little off to the margins, but famous enough almost 30 years after its publication that it became the inspiration for a 1968 Academy Award-winning film starring Alan Arkin. So it has had a huge footprint in American culture.
That age of 23 is really interesting because it seems to show up a number of times. Mary Shelley's 23 when Frankenstein is first published, her first version of Frankenstein. Yeah. And a lot of people prefer that 1818 version as opposed to the 1831 rewrite. So and of course, one of the difficulties you have with a book like this that's so interesting and complex and does so many weird things is you keep saying, wow, and it's written by a 23-year-old. And I guess you always have a question, does that make you overvalorize something? Or are people overly critical because they're saying, well, it was only a 23-year-old when they read it? Maybe they fall both ways.
When a 22-year-old Georgia girl wrote her first book, she became the youngest American writer ever to join the company of immortals. Her name, Carson McCullers. She called her book, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. She told about herself at 16, about what she liked and saw and wanted.
This was the first party I ever gave. I'd never even been to more than four or five.
It was nice if you let me come.
Oh, well, I was flattered you wanted to. I mean, we're so much younger than you. 2 years behind in school.
Oh, well, I didn't have anything better to do.
She told about the man who came to live in her family's house.
The other people had been ordinary, but Mr. Singer was not.
Hi, Mr. Singer. Want to come look at my party?
It seems to me a particularly American thing to seek out these young geniuses and to sort of celebrate the fact. It seems stitched in the very idea of American itself, that our writers are going to be sort of fall out of the clouds, trailing clouds of glory or whatever it is.
Yeah, because in the 80s, you have the Brat Pack writers, yep, Buddy Cinellis exactly. and Jay McInerney. We go back before that and we have the Lost Generation writers all hitting in their early to mid-20s with Fitzgerald and Hemingway and a few of their compatriots and colleagues. And a generation before that, we have Stephen Crane, who's also, I think, 23 mm-hmm. years old when his first novel was published.
Yeah. I think, you know, in Carson McCullers' case, one of the things we'll talk about is how biographically she was sort of cultivated to be this wunderkind. From a very early age, very first short story she ever published, 1936, was called Wunderkind. And it almost seems a sort of self-defeating thing to me is the desire not to grow up. And that's maybe one of the themes that I think occurs in this book. But it's done as a kind of naturalistic treatment of it, as if aging is part of those environmental forces that always crush our individual will. And that can get a little solipsistic, but that'll be later for the conversation. Most people have probably read The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. I was rather amused to discover that it's often categorized now as a young adult novel, which I don't think it should be. That is because one of the main characters is Mick Kelly, who's 13 or 14 throughout the course of this book. But it's really only one of the main characters.
Yeah.
This novel is unique in the sense that it really is about four or five main characters, and you have a lot of contrast going on. It's set in a fictionalized version of a city that's actually not too far from me, Columbus, Georgia. And I should mention that in Columbus, Georgia, there is a Carson McCullers center
right.
that is run out of Columbus State University. It's managed by a faculty member there named Nick Norwood, who does a great job running some programs, literary appreciation programs. They kind of split their time between Columbus and Nyack, New York, where there's another McCullers house.
Ah, and Nick Norwood's a pretty good poet, by the way, for people looking to read his work.
Very well-known poet. So it's kind of neat. He actually zoomed into a class of mine a few years ago to talk about how he ended up being the McCullers person. And one of the things he talked about was how much interest there is in Carson McCullers. And, you know, he was telling me one day, Daniel Craig and his wife showed up in Columbus, Georgia, James Bond and his wife. And her name slips me, but
maybe he's researching his Knives Out Southern
that could be accent,
which normally I always feel that people from England and also Australia do a much better job at faking Southern accents than Americans do who are not from the South. But that accent Knives Out, although I am fond of that movie and I didn't mind its sequel, is pretty horrific to hear.
I think that was his kind of camp way of disassociating himself from James Bond. They also, when they had the centennial celebration there in 2017, they debuted parts of a musical that Suzanne Vega has done of Carson McCullers. So a lot of interest on the part of there's been all kinds of movies that people have tried to get off the ground about McCullers biographically, even though most of her films have been success or most of her novels have successfully been made into movies.
It's funny you said that about it is considered young adult because there's one of the main characters is a young adult. She's 13 turning 14 in the novel, the character of Mick Kelly. Yet, and it's funny because looking back on it, I did think of her as a protagonist of the book. And I was very surprised. This is the first time I've reread the book in over 20 years. It's probably closer to 30 years if I was really getting taken off my shoes and doing the hard math. But I was really actually surprised how little in the first half she is actually in the book. She becomes a more central character in the last half of the novel, or maybe third, but she's really pretty marginalized in the first half, or pretty marginal, I should say. No one's out to take away her rights or anything. But at the very center, like a kind of a hub of a wheel, we have this character, Singer, who's very ironically named because he's deaf mute and can't speak. And he's pretty good at reading lips, but as the book makes clear, he's not a genius at it. And there's this ongoing situation where the other central characters always come to him to pour out their hearts and souls and talk. And it's really fascinating when we finally get to one of his sections, and he clearly doesn't really know what's going on. And very slowly, over the course of the novel, each of these stories evolve until they all kind of reach a closure, mostly not a satisfying closure.
Yeah, defeating. In a lot of ways.
A defeatist closure in many ways toward the end. So now Carson McCullers, if I were to tell someone, oh, this girl from Columbus, Georgia, writes a story set in a nondescript Georgia town, we probably have a lot of things we assume about her. It doesn't take much work with the internet to find out how much that can lead you astray and how interesting and flat out weird her background really is. So I was not really aware that she'd been kind of groomed to be this success. Did her parents have this notion that she was going to be a literary star early on? Or?
Well, her mother, she was born Lulu Carson, and her mother groomed her from an early age to be a genius to the point where, you know, other children in the family were essentially told, you know, Lulu is the smart one. And she was trained as a classical pianist, went to New York to study classical piano in her teens, and then sort of bombed out, as many of us do that are sort of led to believe that we're maybe better than we are. And that was really what got her to switch from music to writing. But, you know, the big issue with Carson McCullers tends to do with gender and sexuality.
Right.
And I think that's really the central focus for most of them. It was very common for people to talk about in the 40s and 50s and 60s, how almost all of her female protagonists, like Carson McCullers herself, was sort of a tomboy figure, an androgynous figure, not traditionally feminine. And in some ways, as the biographies started to come out, very interesting, I think, not just an androgynous figure, but maybe not quite asexual, but certainly more romantic in an innocent way. Yeah. Lots of intense melodramatic crushes. At one point, she was hugely infatuated, almost to the point of stalking Catherine Ann Porter while they were at the writer's retreat yacht.
Which is pretty hilarious when you read about how Catherine Ann Porter is around people. And
yeah, I mean, she was not one to tolerate fools. And,
yeah,
you know, she's at Yaddo with Carson McCullers and Truman Capote and Newton Arvin, who was a closeted professor at the time, who ended up getting fired for receiving Muscle magazines in the mail. So,
well, she marries her Reeves McCullers, I believe is his name.
Right.
Or maybe it's Reeve McCullers, who is in the Army and ends up being, on the one hand, normally we would just routinely say gay, but I guess really, if we're being more accurate, we'd say he's bisexual and that he has affairs with men and women. And Carson eventually figures out what's going on and divorces him. But then she has an affair with one of his boyfriends, and then they get remarried again together. And Reeves also wanted to be a novelist. And they kind of, even for a little while before she started publishing and her career just skyrocketed, competing against each other.
Right.
And he's serious, depressive, and even tries to talk her into a suicide pact at one point. And, you know, there's a thing that the younger people on the internet these days where they talk about polyamorous relationships, and there are all these different ways now that they can qualify gender, all these different ways to qualify romantic entanglements, monogamy and polygamy are too outdated and all that. And it seems to me, Carson McCullers, and when it comes to this stuff, and maybe just, you know, there's kind of two ways we look at it. One is she is herself dealt with serious depression. And does she act out somewhat because of the pressures, or because of the pressures, if her sexuality or gender is not conforming to norms, is that what causes the depression? You know, we don't, which is first, the chicken or the egg, or what is the chicken or the egg
right
in this case? And it does make you wonder if she's living in an age where kind of all the rule books have been tossed out and things are moving in all kinds of new directions. I'm not sure where mental health is going to play its part in all this when it's all said and done, but I'm just curious what it would have been like for her. She starts telling people, well, I think I'm just a lesbian, but she kind of hits on women, but then won't consummate relationships with them. And then goes back, has flings with men, but in some cases choosing gay men that try and have a sexual affair with, which seems to be setting yourself up for disappointment if you're a woman. And so it's just it's really interesting and odd. And of course, it's interesting that because some of this shows up in her work,
right,
it is one of the main things people always want to talk about with her. The biographies tend to become a little more lurid, a little more, you know, we think of the old magazines with the splash pages, and nowadays it would be the headlines on your phone from BuzzFeed or whatever, that are about her various relationships and exposures and not actually about the work itself.
Yeah. Yeah. I think her reputation suffers for the fact that there is as much interest as her as an icon. And I guess the term today we would use is a queer icon.
Yeah.
And that's very important culturally. I think that's part of the attraction to the desire to have musicals and dramatizations of her. I think it's also the fact that she physically suffered from a very early, I mean, she started having strokes when she was in her 20s that were very debilitating, lost sight at one point.
Yeah, she had rheumatic fever, which led to heart disease, which led to those strokes. And she also became an alcoholic, which is one of the worst things that you can do if you have that condition.
Right.
And she dies at the age of 50. So pretty young. And really, because of the strokes, had not been active in her writing or professional career for some years before her death as well.
Yeah, just a couple other points I thought I'd throw in. Reeves McCullers is actually from Wetumpka, Alabama, which is a bedroom community of here in Montgomery. So a little bit of a connection there. Also was in the Army, and that's an important influence because as you move on into her work, Reflections in a Golden Eye is a lot about Army-based life and the sorts of suppressions that go on there. Also, he did commit suicide in Paris after trying to convince her unsuccessfully to join him in a very weird suicide pact. There's a weird sort of immaturity that I think floats throughout the Carson McCullers story that I think is probably holds back her reputation as much as anything. It's this glorification of the wunderkind and the fear of adulthood, we might put it that way. And I think that comes through in this novel, in the character of Mick Kelly. You know, it's a toss-up whether people think Mick Kelly or Frankie Adams in The Member of the Wedding.
Right.
That was another well-known book of hers, is more iconic of a character. But there's also a lot of interesting, you know, still main characters in this book. We have a hardline socialist who's also an alcoholic,
right,
named Jake Blunt, who is coming straight out of the proletariat novel tradition. We have another gender-bending cafe owner named Biff Bannon, who runs the cafe that is sort of the locus where everybody hangs out. And maybe one of the most interesting characters is an African-American main character,
right,
named Dr. Copeland, who is a black man educated in the North, who is attempting to ignite a sort of proto-civil rights movement.
Right.
He gets compared a lot to Martin Luther King because toward the end of the book, he has this vision of leading a march on Washington that is going to make the problem of black people in America foremost as a political revolution.
Well, Richard Wright says of this book, he very much mimics the exact same thing he says about Faulkner, which is, he says, is one of the most important books on race relations ever written at that time. And so Wright was not exactly always forthcoming in praise for white writers as a black writer himself. So, yeah, these characters are fascinating. And there at the center of all of them, we have Singer, the deaf mutant. So we open up with the description of him. He lives for a while with a Greek friend who's also a deaf mute, named Antonopoulos, Spiro Antonopoulos, like you reminded me a second ago. And first, other than being deaf mute, we don't see anything in Spiro's character that would make him particularly likable. He pretty much ignores Singer almost entirely. He's always trying to figure out a way to get more food or treats or drinks, and enjoys Singer's company as long as he brings him drinks or food. But the novel opens with him being taken off to a new town and eventually an asylum. And as a result, Singer's isolated and moves into the boarding house operated by Mick Kelly's parents. And, you know, Kirk, this novel's always talked about as one of those books in the cult of Southern cruelty, like Faulkner and O'Connor and McCullers. And it's often talked about as Southern Gothic. I don't really see any of those elements. I will say it is definitely a Southern novel because of its focus on, particularly on race. But I think mostly we should be talking about the book as a Depression era novel in a lot of ways.
I was going to suggest the best way to think of it is a transitional novel between two different eras. Certainly the book is a lot more in line with the proletariat novel of the 1930s than most people recognize, to the point where Columbus, you know, was a Southern mill city, and Blunt is there trying to organize the workers to strike. And now it's coming right at the end of that era, because, of course, as we move into World War II, that's what ends the Great Depression.
Right.
But it also, in a weird way, looks forward to what's going to be the great themes of the post-World War II era, which is loneliness and isolation and the suffering of the individual soul, the angst, as Kierkegaard would call it.
Right.
Now, it's a little bit different because when you get into the 50s and you're reading books like David Reisman's The Lonely Crowd, that tends to be viewed as a suburban sort of phenomenon, the gray man in gray flannel suit thing, where everybody's sort of rendered numb from the experience of being affluent. But in this case, we're dealing with the working poor or lower middle class families.
Right.
But it's still there very much in a lot of the talk that goes on between Dr. Copeland and Jake Blunt about what capitalism does to the individual.
Right. Well, I was going to say, I think you're really on to something about this idea of loneliness. If we think of one of the premier writers who didn't really do a lot of work in the 50s, but his work had an incredible outsized kind of, you know, ripple effect, and everyone read this guy, would be J.D. Salinger.
Sure.
You know, the Catcher in the Rye, Nine Stories, and then the book of novellas, Raise High, The Roof Beam. All those works are about loneliness in some way or another.
Yeah.
And his great theme is what happens to us? Do we lose our innocence as we grow old? And loneliness. So those things do show up in such, you know, significant ways. So I think that's really important to think about here. So I think that's, you really hit on something, but you're right in that all these characters, you know, they're all trying in some way or another fix the world.
Right.
As well, that they're stuck with. And so over and over again, they come in to see Singer. And one of the things I think that's very fascinating in the book is they all want to speak to him, but none of them really want to hear what he has to say, which eventually leads to his kind of tragic apotheosis. Yeah. So one of the ongoing, pretty overt symbolic gestures in the book, maybe too overt, is the use of mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's always looking into a mirror, always seeing a reflection. And there seems to be a suggestion that people are just using him as a sounding board and really don't care. He just looks at him with this kind of compassionate look on his face. And they always assume that he has their best interest and in mind, right. That he really understands the depths of who they are. And there's one person who doesn't really see that, who's probably the most truthful person in terms of how they see Singer. And that's Biff Brannan, who's a fascinating character in this book, I think. But the rest of them all see him, and they all characterize him and have all these notions about who he is, totally created out of nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that one of the things that can make the book feel a little dated is it comes from that era where, you know, to be literature, you larded the text with symbols.
Yeah.
And Singer is so clearly put forth as a kind of Christ figure.
Yeah.
You know, mute. His muteness is the way of saying, does Christ still exist in, you know, in our spiritual contact? We're looking at these figures of Christ and we're confessing to them, but we get no response back.
Right.
And of course, as you mentioned, the irony is about 2/3 of the way the book, we see Singer writing a letter to Antonopoulos in which he basically says, all of these people annoy the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And I don't know why.
They won't leave me alone. And all they do is complain. They complain.
Yeah.
you know, why won't they? And they all make him into something. So part of this is young Mick Kelly, who starts off as this kind of roaming around town, 12, 13-year-old girl, who's always having to care for her younger siblings and lead them out of the house and keeping them out from being underfoot. And one of the things we see that's sad about Mick is that her childhood and girlhood are cut short because of the depression. She has to drop out of school just before she turns 15 to get a job so that the family can have enough money to keep their house. And the family's already taking in boarders and people. And she's interesting because at first, she sees Singer as just kind of an enigma and a mystery that she romanticizes. Then she starts telling him about how she's going to become this great musician and this. She has all these dreams. And then she becomes fascinated with him as a romantic lead. Mm-hmm. And of course, you talked about the Christ symbolism. Singer's 33 years old in one of the sections of the book. So they're making it, or McCullers made it pretty clear you were supposed to go that route. But to me, that was one of the weirdest things that happens in the book is when Mick develops this full-on romantic crush on the guy who's described as very plain, very simple-looking, kind of gray-skinned almost sometimes, slender in his 30s. And we understand that tweener girls get crushes on movie stars and musicians who are in their 30s and often present themselves as perpetually adolescent. But it seems weirder when it's a boarder in the house who's not like talking her up or buying her things or any of those kind of Humbert grooming things you might think about. This guy's just trying to, I'm not going to say he's trying to be quiet and keep to himself. He is quiet. He can't speak.
He honestly doesn't really care about any of them.
No, he's utterly, in the same way that she's fascinated with him, he's fascinated with Antonopoulos,
yeah,
who seems to care nothing for him other than as a source for stuff. But
well, McCullers herself said one her great theme was the temptation of people in their loneliness to idolize figures and to make sort of religious figures out of people as an effort to sort of make contact with other people. So I think she knew what she was doing there. I also think that it's very interesting because there's some pretty overt political commentary in the novel that is indicative of 1940. You know, we're talking before the United States has officially entered the war. So it's a very interesting period where there's, the war has started.
Yeah.
It's in the first year of the war, but we are not part of it yet. And there's a lot of looming anxiety about what our role is going to be. But fascism is a huge theme in this book, to the point where McCullers claimed that the whole novel was an ironic commentary on fascism. And I'm not quite sure what that means, because I get a little confused.
Yeah.
About the specific, you know, there's a lot of socialism talk. Blunt is a socialist, and Dr. Copeland names one of his kids Karl Marx.
Exactly, he does.
Who prefers to go by Buddy.
But Blunt, hilariously, when he talks about the dialectic and communism, and he's always trying to, you know, do union formation and rabble-rousing, get everyone so angry and worked up. The funny thing about Blunt is he never wants to engage in a conversation with other people.
Right, right.
He only wants to tell them what they're supposed to do and how they do it, and he has to be the guy doing it. And he gets so angry that Copeland has a different way of dealing with it, because Copeland's mostly concerned about race and Blunt is only concerned about the proletariat. And although there's significant overlap, they're not the same thing. And it's a little similar to how an invisible man, the Communist Party, is trying to manipulate the African-American community in New York to do what they want. And the narrator of that novel says, well, we've got different objectives here we need to worry about. And Blunt is, in a way, comes across as kind of simplistic, because he just wants to have someone to yell at. And he thinks Singer's agreeing with everything he says, so he thinks that makes him happy. When someone has a different point of view, he can't stomach it. And so I don't find, at first I was kind of sympathetic to Blunt, thinking he, in my reread, and I'd kind of forgotten about this character until I started rereading it. In my mind, he had become a bit of a Tom Joad. And by the end of the book, he's definitely not. He's a little bit more of just an idiot in a way, who has a kind of one track they can quote and say over and over again, but who never actually gets anything done. He's on rainy days, he's writing chalk messages on the wall, knowing full well that by nightfall, that message isn't going to be there anymore.
He's a sloganeer, and he goes from being Tom Joad to being Tom Chode, as the kids would say. I find arguably the climax of the novel is an argument between Blunt and Copeland. And I find that scene absolutely unconvincing.
Yeah.
I just think, you know, you get these two guys sort of very passionately speaking, trying to convince each other. And if you read summaries of the book, it's interesting, because it argues that the conversation breaks down into trading back racist slurs.
Yeah.
And I think part of what happens is Blunt is so angry and so eager to use blunt force or violence to make a change, to smash things up, that in his anger, he kind of loses his cool and loses the idea of that solidarity is the ultimate purpose here, and that he's not doing a whole lot to create solidarity.
No.
There's a weird line in here where he makes a comment about the world would be better off if this class of oppressed black men were gelded. And that line just jumped out at me this time, because I always think of Benji Compson, the gelding, the great American gelding. His argument basically is that people matter less than the revolution.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of class war.
Yeah. They could be used as a statement if they'd all been so obviously mistreated in that way. And then you could parade them around as a kind of symbol of the horrific, you know, failings of the upper classes and doing that to them.
There's a part of me that wants to argue, and I just think the sense of what these ideologies mean is so unclear in the novel. But there's part of me that wants to argue that Blunt claims to be a socialist, but by the end, in arguing for all of this violence, he's the one who's the fascist.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very much arguing for the blunt use of force and the overthrow, but the imposition of a certain strain of order that comes through authoritarianism rather than collectivism.
Well, there you go. So when you first take political science, one of the first questions you ask yourself, okay, the extreme 20th century extreme left wing represented by Stalin and Chairman Mao, the extreme right wing represented by Hitler, how far different are they in their actual quality of life for the people? And it really is almost a kind of circle.
Exactly. Where
individual liberties at one apex of the circle and at the other end is suppression of the individual, whether you're calling it fascism or that dictatorial totalitarianism, the kind of communism you saw in Mao's China or under Stalin, and the need of people to kind of justify it because, well, you know, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs is where Blunt is coming in, but individuals are nothing to him. He doesn't have any friends at all other than Singer. He doesn't make contact with anyone. He's in the town for, I think the book covers a year and a day,
yeah,
and he has no one else who knows his name even.
The closest contact he has is with this evangelist named Sims.
Right.
And Blunt just can't get with the program, the evangelical program. He wants to always destroy it by sort of shouting out blasphemous things in his anger. I do think where McCullers was really onto something was when she has Dr. Copeland talk about the South was the first great model of fascism.
Yeah.
And that slavery, the oppression of slavery, really was a model for Europe, because historically we've discovered that that's true. You know, the Nazis took a lot of their cues about racial inferiority from the American South.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do think that's an interesting part. I think the whole debate about whether she deserves to be lauded for her empathetic treatment of African Americans is a very fascinating issue. You know, you read you mentioned Richard Wright, and I think it's worth reading actually what he specifically said, if you don't mind me doing that.
Sure.
He says, "To me, the most impressive aspect of The Heart as a Lonely Hunter is the astonishing humanity that enables a white writer for the first time in Southern fiction to handle Negro characters with as much ease and justice as those of our own race. This cannot be accounted for stylistically or politically. It seems to stem from an attitude toward life which enables Miss McCullers to rise above the pressures of her environment and embrace black and white humanity in one sweep of apprehension and tenderness." And I think there was a, you know, if you look back to the 30s, I think that's true in the context of maybe the late 30s, where if you're going to dramatize the race problem, you had either the tragic black Christ figure,
right,
or you had the angry, rapacious Joe Christmas type,
right,
character, who may not even be black.
Who may not even be black, yeah. Faulkner always complicates things.
Hedged his bets on that. Could have been Mexican, you know?
Could have been
Hispanic.
A tan white guy, yeah.
Yeah.
You just don't know.
But everybody assumes he's black, and that's what plants the antisocial disease within him, is that threat of exclusion.
Everyone has to place him, and that wherever he goes, he tries to push back against. However, he demands they place him, then he pushes back against it.
Right. I think where contemporary writers would probably get a little queasy with McCullers' depiction of African-American characters is with Dr. Copeland's children, and specifically with Portia.
Yeah, that's what Willie. I find very interesting, because here we have Dr. Copeland, who is written to be very well educated, well spoken, who has read Karl Marx and his Engels, and is using that. And in fact, he probably has read and understood those materials better than Blunt, the actual socialist agitator, has.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, he can't really, like Blunt, relate to the individual experiences. I think Portia is an interesting character because the whole book, she's trying to repair her fractured relationship with her father.
Mm-hmm.
The father slapped her mother one time, hit her. The mother said, "I'm not putting up with that," and moved out. So he has no real relationship with his children. She's trying to repair it. And that I find fascinating, and her willingness to meet him halfway, to draw him out of himself, to fight back against his bitterness, I find to be a really interesting relationship.
Yeah.
But I think you're right in that when we look at how she portrays Portia's maternal grandfather, her brother, her husband, their things get a little hokey and cheesy. It's a little Disney Song of the South kind of stuff going on there a little bit.
Yeah, there's a great New Yorker article by Hilton Alls from the early 2000s where he mentions the fact that she, for somebody who supposedly identifies or does not depict another race as the other, she sure uses the word woolly headed and big lips, and the black dialect is a little insufferable, I think, to most contemporary readers. I think she was really trying to depict a class difference between Dr. Copeland and his children. Willie, you mentioned Portia, but Willie is actually also a Christ figure. Yeah. I mean, he, you know, gets incarcerated for getting into a fight at the local brothel, and the police hang him upside down to the point where his legs get gangrene and they have to cut off. But that scene where they talk about Willie being hung upside down with his arms out, I mean, that's just another crucifixion image there. So,
and again, Willie doesn't want to stir up trouble. He doesn't want to have anything happen. Blunt's trying to say, I'm going to parade you around in a wagon. We can talk about it. He says, no, I just want to be left alone. I don't want any more trouble, you know, and just hand me another drink. And I do think those depictions are somewhat problematic. And I think, you know, the answer really can be in these cases, both and.
Yeah.
On the one hand, compared to most white writers of the day, and not a fair number of black writers of that day, she is very sympathetic in trying to show the horror of what's going on, where she just says, this is how they treated. And also, Dr. Copeland goes down to complain, and a bigoted deputy just throws him in a jail cell for daring to come try and talk to the judge. You know, an elderly, educated doctor who's been helping the community for all these years and gets no respect and is treated so horribly. Yet at the same time, she's using certain descriptions, certain kinds of vernacular. Now, to put it in context, so did Zora Neale Hurston writing a few years before this time, who is herself a black woman writer. So part of it is it's of that day and age. It doesn't mean we shouldn't interrogate it and point it out when we see it and its problems. But at the same time, I think we always have to judge it partly based on context anyway.
Well, it raises a very interesting question about, do you have the right to depict another, you know, as an artist, to depict another person of another race or another culture? And can you do it in a way that sort of proves that you've familiar enough or sensitive enough to avoid the pitfalls and the cliches and the stereotypes? It's really interesting to read McCullough's criticism, because I would say people are split almost 50-50 about her depiction of Dr. Copeland.
Right.
There are a lot of people that echo Richard Wright and find it really a nuanced portrait. But at the same time, there's a lot of people that criticize it as a kind of tragic black martyr figure. I mean, you mentioned his ambition to cart Willie around in a wagon. Who ends up in a wagon at the you know, who ends up, the last thing we see of Dr. Copeland is him.
He's in the wagon, right? Well, you know, there is a bit of Dr. Copeland, though, that is like Blunt in that he's talking this stuff. He gets so angry at the other black people in the book. They're not educated in the way he is. And when he talks to them, he's always condescending to them so much and looking down at them for not having, you know, risen to his level of eloquence or understanding or education. And he's constantly angry and frustrated. And again, it's a case of seeing the big picture, but not being able to connect to the individuals as such.
I always wondered if McCullers wasn't sort of shading a little bit of W.E.B. Du Bois into Dr. Copeland. I don't know that she was necessarily historically aware of enough to maybe do this, but, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois, who had the famous sort of running argument with Booker T. Washington.
Right.
He got knocked a little bit from the 20s on about almost having a certain shame about Southern rural blacks.
Right.
And there's a great novel out of the 20s called Infants of the Spring by Wallace Thurman that is a roman à clef. I mean, it has Zora Neale Hurston in it quite clearly and a lot of that crowd from the Harlem Renaissance. But there's a W.E.B. Du Bois figure that kind of comes in and starts pontificating, and they essentially make fun of him. It's a great generation gap novel. And I sort of see a little bit of that going on, although I don't think nothing I've ever read says that she was necessarily aware of sort of Du Bois' reputation amongst black writers.
She's up there in New York in the very heyday of the Harlem Renaissance, so it's not inconceivable that she's, you know, as she goes up to Columbia and is hanging out up there and starts working on the book, that she isn't talking to friends in the publishing and writing business who wouldn't share literary gossip in a way writers love to do. And the other character we haven't talked about that is maybe the most interesting, weirdest of them is Biff Brannan.
Right.
So if I tell you we're going to have a character who's a big, hulking guy with the shaggy beard who runs a diner and bar and yells at people all the time named Biff Brannan. We're going to have a series of things we think about that character. And then everything throughout the book goes topsy-turvy with who this guy seems to be at the very beginning. At first, he seems to be, he's kind of henpecked, but maybe brings it on himself by not really being sympathetic to his wife.
Who's very ill.
Yeah, who's very ill. And then when she dies, he's completely undone.
Yeah.
Then he becomes fascinated with Mick Kelly. And Kirk, I don't know really what to make of Brannan's fascination with her. I mean, the dark side of...
I think it's almost an envy of her androgyny. Because one of the things that happens is after his wife dies, he begins wearing her perfume.
Yep.
And, you know, he kind of slips into a curious androgyny himself. And I think part of that is, you know, McCullers really emphasized with the, and again, I use this term advisedly, with the freaks, with the, what we today would call the queer culture, the idea of people that, you know, break down the dichotomies of gender and exist somewhere in the in-betweenness of them.
He's the only one who, when he looks at Singer, he doesn't see him as the Wandering Jew or Karl Marx Jr. or a Christ figure or a love interest. He just says, seems to be a lonely deaf guy all these people talk to. And he himself, out of not having anyone else to really talk to, and he tries to reach out to Blunt in friendship and it fails. He tries to reach out a couple other times to people.
But as the novel goes on, he almost gets content in his isolation. He spends more and more time downstairs reading the newspaper, kind of locked away from the world. And there's that sense that he's withdrawn from active engagement as well.
Right. That relationship with Mick is just weird enough that you worry, okay, is he supposed to be a pedophile? But it becomes very clear, I think, that no, instead, he has made her into a symbol of something. You know, is it androgyny? Is it innocence? Is it the fact that she is free and clear to be who she wants to be and however she, because not only is she a tomboy early on, but she also is out kind of roaming the streets in the middle of the night. She comes in and buys beer or buys cigarettes and he kind of gives it to her when she does this. And she just thanks Mac, you know, and has a kind of tough guy attitude with him. Yeah,
that reflects some of the freedoms that Lulu Carson Smith was given by her mother.
Ah.
All the biographies talked about the fact that the mother and the daughter, when Carson was all of 14, would sit on the stoop of the house and smoke together, which is sort of funny to think about.
It is. And that idea, of course, of being precocious in terms of a lot of ways also brings us to, at some point, Mick decides she wants to be more of a girl. She wants to be older. So she starts dressing a bit more in a more feminine way. She has a prom party, and I had no idea what that was. And then I didn't know this is what the meaning of it was, but they promenade around the neighborhood. They go on walks together. So you don't just have a dance with someone. You also have a walk with them. And that's what where that term comes from. And I guess I had maybe known that at some point and forgotten it. And she kind of chooses a boy who, again, had been the kind of weird Jewish kid everyone picked on, but who actually seems to have some depth and be kind of interesting. And she chooses him as someone to just kind of experiment with and fool around with. And there doesn't seem to be any real romantic feeling there.
It has to be one of the most dispassionate deflowering scenes ever.
Yeah.
I mean, they lose their virginity to each other, and it's just so.
She shakes his hand at the end of the night, right?
and he's freaked out about it. I mean, he kind of goes into this tailspin of angst and thinks he's ruined her. And
we've sinned, and I'll marry you if you want to. And she's like, what? Why?
Yeah. But it's not a sexual awakening. I mean, both of them sort of retreat almost immediately back into their weird innocence. And I think that's, again, very typical of this desire to romanticize the innocent.
Yeah.
The idea that we can all sort of retain the inner child in us. I used to like that theme when I was young, but now that I'm old, I get irritated by it.
I can't think of many other books that have a 14-year-old girl character set out to do this, or because, yeah, she turns 15 in the next section of the book. So she's only 14. Set out to do something like this and then have it not be something that is a major consideration of her. You know, it's right. covered a bit over the rest of that chapter, and then it's just something in the past. At first, she thinks everyone's going to look at her and see her differently or think about her differently, and no one notices anything's different about her. It's not like her circumstances have really changed. And like you said, then it's just kind of part of the past. And you were talking about reading criticism of the book. It is interesting, you know, when people look at Singer and his fixation on Antonopoulos, there's a lot of people just automatically assume they're gay. I think that's probably not an incorrect assumption, but the weird thing about it is that there doesn't ever seem to be any kind of physical connection between them.
Well, Antonopoulos, too, if you read some of the criticism, people will come out and refer to Antonopoulos as mentally handicapped. I mean, it's almost, there are some readings of him that almost turn him into Benji Compson. I mean, he clearly has mental issues, but yes. I think that that is McCullough's way of, again, sort of depicting the Southern freak or the outsider who's just touched and can't, has to exist in their own bubble because they're so special. But
right.
society doesn't want to deal with people that are weird, so we send them away to these homes and cut off whatever nourishment, emotional nourishment, they might have gotten out of other people.
Right. Although the person who's getting emotional nourishment is not Antonopoulos, it's Singer.
Right, Singer.
Antonopoulos, I think, actually is probably mentally deranged in that his need to consume constantly. So we're back to the title of the book, if you think about it, Heart is a Lonely Hunter, which comes from a poem that McCullers is quoting. And each of these people seems to be so desperate for connection and so lonely. And in each case, Singer accepted, they seem to be their own worst enemy in terms of isolating themselves, keeping themselves separate. Other than Mick, who I don't think is necessarily completely isolated or alone because her family is a very big part of her situation. It's really more their economic circumstances and the depression that seems to be what they're dealing with. And with Singer, you get the feeling that as everyone pours into him, he has no one to talk to.
Right.
No one to express himself to. And he just is bottled up and becomes more and more and more isolated until finally he just has he decides to kill himself. Yeah. And as always, there are spoilers in this episode. I guess we should have. Whether or not he and Antonopoulos are gay seems to me to be beside the point. The problem is he doesn't have anyone to express himself to.
Yeah.
It's not about his sexuality. It's about his humanity.
There's a lot of descriptions of talk in the book and how people feel the need to be voluble, how they feel the need to be express themselves, feel the need to be heard. Right. And I think what Singer represents is the idea that that burden of hearing is, you know, it's hard on people. It's a lot of emotional energy that he doesn't have, that people are asking from him to be the person that receives you and understands you, in a sense, again, that forgives you for whatever your transgressions or sins are.
So when it's all said and done, we have this Depression-era novel that is dealing with complicated sexualities by a number of the characters. It's dealing with race. It's dealing with communism and socialism and the rise of fascism. And the question is then, is it really a great American novel? It's certainly American. I think the heft of it, it's long enough that we're not saying it's really a short story or anything like that. But I guess, and certainly about American themes, but is it, when it's all said and done, a significant artistic accomplishment? Or is there a durability brought about by, you know, aesthetic value?
So I may upset some people here, but I'm going to argue that it falls just short of being a great American novel. And it comes closer than our previous one that we said fell short, which was Joan Didion's Play It As It Lays. But here I think it's really, I was trying to articulate this feeling to myself, so I may not say it as clearly as I want to, but I think when we talk about this notion of greatness, this notion of epic, there's a sort of centrifugal energy, an outward bound energy that comes from that. And I think that for McCullers, the energy is more going, it's more centripetal. It's more going to the inside. And I don't mean to say that great American novels have to end rah-rah in the way The Grapes of Wrath does, where you have everybody sort of collectively pledging to be part of the fight and to join in this community. We've seen novels that end on notes of isolation, like Moby Dick. But if you think of the ending of this book, we have, and compare it to Moby Dick, in Moby Dick, we have the individual isolated in this great, bleak, terrorizing landscape, all alone, an orphan, and really dependent upon his own sort of powers of survival. Here we have almost more of a naturalistic novel in which the individuals are ground down by the forces around them.
Yeah.
And she was very specific about that. She didn't use the term naturalism, but she compared Southern literature, and she did not like the term Gothic, but she said that Southern writers did what the Russian realists were doing in dealing with the conditions of a peasant class. But I think there's just not that sense of the outward boundness of this. I mean, we see Blunt fleeing, we see Copeland dying, we see Bannon retreating, and we see Singer is dead, we see Mick condemned to a conventional life, unimaginative life without art.
Right.
And there's no sense of any possible fight or any sort of vigor left in the novel at the end. It's a tragedy in that regard, but at the same time, it doesn't quite have the anger that maybe Faulkner's tragedies have on behalf of history, or just sort of that sort of outward bound kind of energy
right.
that to me is what an epic is all about.
You know, I've reread a lot of books. In fact, I guess I've had read every novel we've done on the podcast before. And I'm trying to think there's exceptions there might be, but this is the first one that I hadn't read in 25 years or so. And I have to say, I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to. And when we talked about Joan Didion, I said, I think this is a great American writer, but I don't think it's a great American novel.
Yeah.
Here, I don't know if I think that Carson McCullers is, with her abbreviated career, truly a great American writer completely. But this book, I don't know. I'm kind of fence straddling, Kirk. I might lean a little more towards having done it because it does evoke these characters so fully in little isolated places. One of the things that I'm a little bit tired of these days is all the doorbuster 600-page books with multiple characters, and we get 100 pages of this person and 200 of that person and 300 of that, and it goes on and on. And I'm thinking of people like Jonathan Franzen. There are a number of others we could mention where they have all the pieces, but there's a lack of heart to the writing. And here, at least, I did find heart and compassion.
Yeah.
So I think what you're saying is really interesting, and it gives me something to think about. I'm falling in the marginally still in the great American novel side of things myself. Although, again, a lot of your points I think are really well made.
Well, let me qualify this a little bit because I teach this in Southern literature and I love teaching it. And it's always one of the most popular books. And I think it is precisely because of what you say, the element of the heart and the desire to reach out and the empathy for these characters. There's nothing wrong with treating your characters humanistically rather than crushing them the way that Faulkner seems to do.
Right.
The other thing I might say about this, and this is kind of an interesting conversation to have, is I'm not sure there's a consensus that The Heart of a Lonely Hunter is actually McCullers' masterpiece. A lot of people argue that the novella, The Ballad of the Sad Cafe, is actually her best work. Now, she had, you know, a lot of her works are very famous. She followed this up with Reflections in an Old Golden Eye, which was panned mercilessly.
Yeah.
You talk about a sophomore slump. But that book, to a certain extent, was redeemed by the Marlon Brando movie that came out in the 60s, which I think made people go back to it. But certainly, The Member of the Wedding, which was made into both a play and a movie. And then Ballad of the Sad Cafe. And people really, I think, look at that novella as being, maybe a more mature work, which is an interesting word to use with McCullers. I guess the other real reason that I would not do this is because I would not classify it as a GAN. And it probably is my own prejudice against this sort of valorization in American culture of the Wunderkind.
Yeah.
I think it's a hugely self-defeating thing where you set yourself up for a lack of success. And when you, now again, 22-year-old me would never have agreed with this, but the idea of embracing maturity. And of course, Leslie Fiedler has a whole book of this called Love and Death in the American Novel, where he says American writers are afraid of adult responsibilities and adult commitments. But I do think there's something to be said for being very leery of taking a character like McKelly and sort of holding her up as the great American tragedy because she's condemned to this life of the ordinary as opposed to the gifted.
Right.
So that might be my other equivocation. There's something just a little in that inwardness, something just a little self-absorbed or solipsistic about it.
Yeah.
And that's a common complaint against McCullers' work.
One of the things that you see in The Member of the Wedding that you only have hints of it in here, it's also about a 13-year-old tomboy is the central character. The main character is a 12-year-old tomboy.
Right.
What you have going, though, in Member of the Wedding is actually a lot more humor.
Mm-hmm.
And you see little moments of it in here, especially in the mixed sections when she's dealing with other kids. And she kind of gives that free rein in The Member of the Wedding. And so that's anyone who's interested, I think you'll see that the book clearly is kind of setting itself up almost as if, what if she just wrote a book about Mick?
Yeah.
Off in a different direction.
If folks have not seen the picture that I'm about to describe, you should go look it up. There is an amazingly uncomfortable photo from the Broadway production. Member of the Wedding. Frankie Adams was played by Julie Harris. The African-American maid character was played by Ethel Waters. And so there's a picture of them backstage where Carson McCullers is literally clinging to Ethel Waters. And it's it's just such a, you know, in our sort of post-Toni Morrison, post-Alice Walker age, it's a very difficult picture to look at and not see how this generation of Southern exiles like her and Truman Capote and to a certain extent Les Tennessee Williams all sort of identified it with Black people in the ways that kind of approached appropriation.
Yeah. The play is interesting because some anthologies have the play in there for their McCullers section instead of the novel. And of course, like any play, it's not going to have the things a novel has, and it's a little more complicated. But it's interesting we diverted over to The Member of the Wedding because the cannon fodder book we wanted to talk about this week is actually about a wedding, and it comes out within the same year that Member of the Wedding comes out, which is 6 years after The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, and that's Delta Wedding by Mississippi writer Eudora Welty.
Right. I would argue that this is really the counterpoint to the Southern Gothic, where you have a story about a Southern family, about the traditions, the interdependencies. It's a coming-of-age novel. One of my favorite scenes in it is one of the sisters is reading F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Beautiful and Damned under the bedsheets because it's such a scandalous book. But it's a novel that I think is also humane in a less freaky sort of way.
Right.
You know, we don't have these distortions inflicted upon people.
No.
And I think in some ways it's probably, you know, I'm not sure that accuracy is necessarily an important quality in literature, but it gives us a sense of that the normalcy can be beautiful too.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about Delta Wedding is it's not generally considered one of Welty's greatest works. I mean, that novel came out, but she was praised in the early 40s much more as a short story writer.
Right.
And if there's a single novel of hers that is considered a masterpiece, it's the much later work, The Optimist Daughter.
Right. Although I think of Optimist Daughter a little bit. I mean, I think it's a good book, but it's a little bit like Faulkner finally winning Pulitzer Prize for a fable, which is far and away his worst book. And Optimist Daughter is a good book, but really it's almost a makeup award for her being ignored a lot as a younger writer.
Yeah.
It also, I think, is a fascinating novel because here's clearly someone writing who's very aware of what Faulkner has done and is also aware of what James Joyce has done. And there's this whole interesting kind of a mythopoetic underlying structure in Delta Wedding. So we have a humorous story about our wedding based on the myths in the way that Ulysses is by Joyce, but at the same time with this kind of Southern focus, like we see from his, it's a fascinating book, and it's definitely, who knows, maybe it'll show up on this podcast one day if we get to a point where some of these canon fodders, we end up trying harder to canonize them.
That'd be great. I actually thought up another canon fodder that I was going to throw out there.
Okay.
From just 3 years later, that I'm not sure that this book is well remembered, although it was a huge bestseller. But Betty Smith's A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Ah.
You know, I've taught that a couple times in classes, coming of age novels classes, and that's another one that people really enjoy. I think it's an interesting contrast to The Heart is a Lonely Hunter because it's a much more conventional Bildungsroman.
Right.
I mean, the main character does grow up into adulthood and does overcome poverty.
Right.
And does, you know, triumph, and it's a much more uplifting work. It was a work that was very consoling in 1943 and 1944 when it was a huge hit because that's sort of the turning point of the war years.
Yeah, runaway bestseller,
later
turned into an award-winning movie.
Yep. Just gave sort of people some optimism and hope. So if readers haven't looked or thought about that book for a long time, that might be another great contrast to go seek out.
Interesting. Kirk, tell us about our next novel.
Our next novel we're going to do is another fairly recent one. It is Don DeLillo's White Noise, which came out in 1985. I think it's considered kind of the quintessential postmodernist novel, least of the 80s. Captures a lot of the sense of weirdness of consumer culture and technology. Was recently made into a movie that I don't think was entirely successful in capturing the feel of that book.
It's also an academic satire and is pretty remarkably prescient about where things were going to head, at least the humanities side of the academy in over the next 30 or 40 years.
Very few books promote both Hitler and Elvis studies. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, everyone, we thank you again for listening to the Great American Novel Podcast. Please follow us on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. If you're so inclined, please leave a review. If you've enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy others such as Master of the 40 with Kirk and Robert Trogdon, focusing on the short stories of Scott Fitzgerald, and Reading McCarthy with myself and various guests about the works of Cormac McCarthy.
And we love getting feedback. In the past few months, we've had some really encouraging email responses, and we appreciate that. Please remember, you can always reach out to us at greatamericannovelpodcast@gmail.com. We thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.